Molecules of sugar latched to contact sites, and the nerves ran through the meat of her tongue back into her body like she was drinking twice, once with the liquid and once with electrical fire. A sense of vertigo washed through her. She tried to put the bulb down, but the surface of the table was distant, visible but through a distracting cloud that was the air, atoms and molecules bouncing against each other, striking and spinning away and striking again. Thicker than bodies at a tube station. She tried to call out to Vaughn. She could see him, right there before her, the jagged territory of his skin fractally similar at every scale. She tried to make out his expression, but she couldn't bring her focus back that far. It was like trying to see the face of God. Something hummed and throbbed, ticking faster than she could quite be aware of. The pulse of her own brain, the tempo of her consciousness. It sang like a chorus, and she heard herself hearing it. She dropped the bulb. It clattered against the table, rolled and dropped to the ground, falling closed so that it kept even a drop of tea from escaping. Vaughn took a step, then sank down to his knees. His eyes were wide, and his face pale as death and covered by sweat. Drummer sat slowly. Her knees felt weak. "God," Vaughn said. "They say God." Drummer couldn't tell if it was a profanity or prayer. The timer on the display read 2 minutes and 20 seconds. Whatever had happened, it had taken almost 3 minutes out of her life. It hadn't seemed that long. Maybe she passed out? "I need," she began, and her voice felt strange, like she could still hear overtones fluting up from her vocal cords. "I need to know what that was." "I don't," Vaughn said. He was weeping, wide, thick tears dripping down his cheeks. "Vaughn," she snapped, and it sounded more like her own voice again. "Come to. I need to know what that was."
"I saw everything," he said.
"How widespread? What happened? Everything. Get me reports."
"Yes," he said, and then a moment later, "Yes, ma'am."
But he rested his head on his knees and didn't move. On the display, the timer came to 12 seconds, and the Tempest fired. Not missiles, but the magnetic beam that Saba had reported. The thing that had stripped the defenses from the slow zone and burst gamma radiation out all the gates. Palace Station vanished like a blown-out candle, with 11 seconds to spare. They were roughly 5 light minutes away, so it had happened. The two things had happened together in the Tempest's frame of reference.
"Tour," she said. "Get me Cameron Tour."
The thing you have to understand is that the technology of the ring stations doesn't break the speed of light, Tour said, his Adam's apple bobbing like a ball on a string. "The only thing we can absolutely say is that the protomolecule is bound by the speed of light. Everything they designed got around it with a different understanding of locality. That's not the same thing at all." He was talking fast, and Drummer thought more than half to himself. That she was in the room let him think out loud, but he didn't have his science advisor voice tuned up. This was one step short of a chimpanzee shrieking and pointing at the charred spot where lightning had struck. "If you look at it, the gates themselves are clearly bounded by light speed. The strategy the protomolecule employs is to send out bridge builders at subluminal speeds to environments where there are stable replicators to hijack and employ to poke holes into a different space. Going from Solgate to Laconia or Illis or wherever, we don't accelerate ships past light speed, we just take a shortcut, because the slow zone is a place outside locality where very different places and our reference can be very nearby in that frame.
That's great, Drummer said. Was it a weapon?
Tuor goggled at her.
Was what a weapon?
That.
She waved her fingers in front of his eyes. That whatever the hell it was. With the hallucinations and the missing time. Was it a weapon? Can the Laconians turn us off like that anytime they want?
It was associated with their weapon, Tuor said. I mean, it happened at the same time, but that's the thing. Time doesn't actually work like that.
The same time is a weird linguistic fantasy. It doesn't exist. Simultaneity doesn't act like this.
He waved his arms, flapping them out toward the sides of the room.
This.
The whatever the hell it had been hadn't just happened in Drummer's meeting room or on people's home. It had been spread throughout the system, Earth and Mars, Saturn's moons and Jupiter's. Even the science stations on moons around Neptune and Uranus and the deep labs in the Kuiper Belt. The reports were startlingly similar. Hallucinations and lost time that began uniformly at the moment the Tempest had fired its magnetic weapon at Palace Station, or, more accurately, the moment in the Tempest's frame of reference.
Tuor seemed very specific about that, like it was important.
But it didn't happen when they fired it in the slow zone, Drummer said.
Why didn't Medina have this happen?
What?
Oh, no, we don't know. The ring space and the station there and the gates, we don't know what their relationship is with normal space. The rules of physics may be different. I mean, it's clearly an active system, and the energy output from the magnetic weapon there was smaller than the gamma bursts that came from it, so it was tapping into an energy supply that didn't have anything to do with the Tempest, per se. But the thing is, I'm not sure that was a propagating event. If it wasn't a propagating event, then maybe it didn't violate light speed.
I don't know what that means, Drummer said between clenched teeth.
Well, I mean, when you drop a pebble in a pond, there are ripples. They propagate, and all propagation is limited by light speed. But instead of a pebble, imagine you dropped a sheet of plating, so that the surface of the plating hit the surface of the pond everywhere at once. It doesn't matter that the trigger that dropped the plate was in one place, because it happened everywhere. Not a point location, but a non-localized location.
Non-localized location, Drummer said, pressing her palms into her eye sockets. Annoyance and fear curled in her throat.
So, you're telling me you don't know shit, floated at the back of her mouth.
Everyone would experience it as if the effect began exactly with them and then propagated away in every direction at the speed of light. But, in reality,
I don't care, she said.
It was still harsh, but less than what she wanted to do.
Tuor reared back from her anyway.
What it is, what it means about the way you understand the universe or physics, I don't care. None of that matters to me. But they just demonstrated a weapon that, at its minimum, ripped Palace Station down to hyper-accelerated dust. I am preparing to lead thousands of soldiers on hundreds of ships into battle against this thing.
You need to tell me, was that a glitch in consciousness because of their attack, or can they make that happen again anytime they want?
Did they know it was going to happen? Did they suffer all the same high weirdness that we did? Because if they can turn our brains off for a few minutes at will, I'm going to need some very different strategies.
By the end, she was shouting. She hadn't meant to shout.
Tuor had his hands up, palms toward her, like he was afraid she might attack.
Fine. Let him wonder. Maybe it would focus him up.
Tuor took a deep breath. Let it out slowly.
I feel comfortable saying that the glitch, if that's what we're calling it, was associated with Tempest's attack on Pallas. Given that it didn't happen in the slow zone, I can't say whether it was a controlled effect or an artifact of the weapon with some quality of local space around Sol. All right, Drummer said. Whether the enemy anticipated it or not, I can't say.
That's fair, Drummer said.
The first pricks of regret were forming at the back of her mind. She shouldn't have yelled at him. And I can't say whether they suffered the same effect, but I would guess they did. If I'm right about the mechanism, there isn't any sort of shielding against it. You can't block something that's already there. That's what non-propagating means. It doesn't come from any place. Everywhere it is, that's where it came from. Drummer leaned back. That, at least, was interesting. If the Laconians had to go through the same thing she had every time they fired their big gun, it would make a gap when automated systems might be able to penetrate their defenses. We're also seeing the increased quantum creations and annihilations much more broadly, Tour was saying somewhere nearby. Like, system-wide, broadly. And there's early suggestion that some experiments on Neptune and Luna that were working with controlled entanglement structures collapsed. So maybe... Drummer leaned back in her chair, folded her hands together. Her eyelids fell to half-mast. She knew, they all knew, that this was the first time one of the Laconian ships had left its home system. This wasn't only an invasion. It was also a shakedown cruise. And nothing ever went completely as expected on a shakedown. The question was whether the Laconians knew what had happened, whether they'd been anticipating it. If they'd been taken by surprise as well, they might not risk using the magnetic beam again. Tour wouldn't be able to tell her that, or Vaughn or Laughlin. Admiral Trejo could say it, but not to her, which meant... there was only one plausible way for her to find out. Her heart leaped at the idea, and she waited for the joy to fade before she risked thinking about it again. It was always dangerous when the universe fell down in a pattern where the thing you wanted and the wise path were the same. Somewhere, Tour was still talking. He might as well have been on another ship. Drummer's mind pressed through the possibilities, the dangers, the possible profits, and the certain loss. Each time she found herself at the same conclusion. She thanked Tour, using the social conventions of conversation to signal him it was time for him to go. She even shook his hand to make up a little for losing her temper before. As she walked him to the door, he was still talking about locality and signal loss. She closed the door behind him and went back to her desk. Vaughn answered the connection request like his finger had been hovering over the button.
Ma'am?
The Tempest is going to make a report. It may go back to Medina or route through Medina back to Laconia, she said. We're going to find out what it says.
Yes, ma'am.
And how are we going to do that?
Saba. She said.
The risk is worth it now. We're reopening communications with Medina. Chapter 35. Sing. An improvised explosive device punctured a liquid oxygen storage tank on deck 4 of the engineering section, Overstreet said. He was reading from a report that scrolled by on the monitor wrapped around his thick forearm. We've recovered very little of the device itself, but what few pieces we have indicate it was made with material common to this facility. It'll be difficult, if not impossible, to track the exact source. Singh sat and listened to the report, and tried to look present and thoughtful. But the truth was, his mind was bouncing around like a tiny animal trying to escape a predator. He found he only processed about half of what Overstreet was saying. His hands were shaking so badly that he didn't trust himself to pick up the glass of water on the desk in front of him. He kept them under the desk, where Overstreet wouldn't see them. The sense that he was in immediate danger was inescapable because it was true. The damage to that deck was significant. Total loss of the primary LIOC storage. The thrust from the breach caused the station's maneuvering thrusters to fire, and the shaking knocked down several structures in the habitat cylinder. The network traffic station for the storm was completely destroyed. A backup environmental systems plant was significantly damaged and will probably not be repairable. "The storm," Singh said. "My first command. The symbol of Laconian power at Medina." "This is preliminary, of course," Overstreet replied, flicking one finger to skip down the report on his arm. "It does seem like that might have been the target of this attack. So minor hull damage and the loss of one sensor array feels like we got off light." Singh's hands felt like they were shaking hard enough to be visible, even under the desk, so he gripped his thighs with both hands and held on tight. "Preliminary casualty reports?" "Again, light," Overstreet said. "This time we have 5 confirmed Laconian fatalities, 3 from the engineering detail, 2 from security. 7 injuries ranging from life-threatening to minor. Only 2 locals confirmed dead at this time, but we also have another 12 missing, so that number will probably go up." To be willing to do so much damage to their own station, to their own people, just trying to hurt us, Singh said, then trailed off. "We have several persons of interest in custody," Overstreet said. "One of them was setting off alarms immediately before the blast. It's possible he wasn't involved, but the coincidence seems unlikely. I will be debriefing him once we're done here." "Is he local?" "A former captain of a transport union ship, James Holden." Singh frowned. "Why do I know that name?" "Apparently he's something of a celebrity, sir. He was involved in the Io campaign and the defeat of the Free Navy back in the day." Both things had happened when Singh was a child, the old guard still playing old guard games. "We will need to make the strongest possible response to this," Singh said. Overstreet nodded, his face grim. The hesitation meant something that Singh didn't understand. "Sir, the radical factions of the Outer Planets Alliance fought a guerrilla war with Earth and Mars for nearly 2 centuries. The veterans of that war are almost certainly in leadership positions in this insurgency. That means we have some difficult decisions to make about the scope of response." "I'm sorry," Singh said. "I'm not following." "Insurgencies are historically nearly impossible to eradicate for a few very simple reasons. The insurgents don't wear uniforms. They look just like the innocent populace, and they're the friends and family of that populace. This means that every insurgent killed tends to increase recruiting for the insurgency, so unless we are willing to rack up a sizable civilian casualty count, we can't just shoot everyone we suspect. If we take the strongest possible response, we stop calling it counterinsurgency and start calling it genocide." "I see," Singh said. He'd studied counterinsurgency and urban pacification at the academy, of course. Afghanistan had been impossible to conquer going all the way back to Alexander the Great. Ireland in the 20th century. The Belter Troubles for the last 2 centuries. It was different reading about it. But now he saw how this cycle of violence could go on and on for him, too. "I'm not prepared to execute every Belter on the station." Overstreet seemed to relax without visibly moving at all. "I agree, sir. All we can do is make it harder for them to operate," Overstreet said. We're going to have Marines enter every compartment on the station. Anything we don't control or have immediate use of will be sealed and the atmosphere removed. It won't end this, but it'll make it harder for them to plan and execute with no spaces under their control.
Agreed, Singh said. You have authorization to conduct this operation and shut down any sections of the station you see fit. Let's see if these people can work in daylight, not hiding in the sewers.
Overstreet stood and saluted, then headed for the door. But just before he left, he turned back as if suddenly remembering something.
Sir, you might consider putting more pressure on your civilian informants. This is exactly the sort of thing they should be doing for us.
Yes, Singh agreed. That's next on my list.
The belter with the badly broken nose, Jodao, Singh thought he called himself, was ushered into the office by two Marines. They held him by the arms, his feet barely touching the ground. His expression was somewhere between angry and sniveling.
Put him down, Singh told the Marines.
When Jodao moved toward a chair, he said, Don't sit.
Sabe, Bosmang.
You know about the attack?
Singh's hands had mostly stopped shaking after Overstreet left, so he took a sip of his water. It was all play-acting. Look calm, casual, in control. Make Jodao feel like Singh already knew the answer to every question he was asked. Make him afraid to lie. It seemed to be working. Jodao rubbed his hands together and bobbed his head like a supplicant.
Yes, boss, I heard.
It shook the station hard enough to knock down buildings in the drum section, Singh said. So, of course, everyone knows about it.
I'm not asking that. I'm asking if you know about it.
Knew the underground was up to something then. But details? I don't...
Because, you see, Singh continued, I released your sister from our lockup as a down payment for future services rendered. Services like letting me know when a bomb was going to blow up half the engineering section of my station, for example.
All the servility left Jordao's face. Singh watched it happen, like a switch had been flipped in the man's head. He was a man who would grovel only so far and no farther. It was a useful fact about him, though it did seem to diminish his value.
Old OPA them, Sasaki. The ones the inners couldn't kill, Jordao said, not attempting to hide his thick belter accent now. The ones like me, we never get to know.
Before you leave this room, you will give me a list of every name you think might be involved in this underground so we can add them to our surveillance list. You will also make sure that whatever happens next, you are part of it, so that we can catch the conspirators in the act and bring the full force of the law against them.
Jordao was shaking his head.
Kenna nothing, you...
Or, Singh continued, I will have your sister rearrested, tried for larceny and crimes against the Empire, and hanged in a public space as a warning to others.
Before Jordao could respond, Singh nodded at his Marines, and they picked the belter up off the floor again.
He doesn't leave until his list is delivered and verified.
Copy that, sir, one Marine said, and saluted with a hand that wasn't holding Jodao.
The belter looked from him to the Marine and back again, understanding blooming in his eyes. Understanding and fear. When it was over, and he was alone in his office, Santiago Singh felt that he very much wanted to send a message to his wife. Tell her how afraid he was. Tell her that maybe accepting this assignment had been a terrible mistake. That walking the line between the man he had always thought he was and the ruthless authoritarian ruler the job required of him wasn't something he could do and remain whole. That the man who could order civilian deaths as a reprisal could not share the same space with the man who loved his wife and played with his daughter,
and couldn't wait for her to get old enough so he could buy her a kitten. But he couldn't make that call, because the explosion had cut the storm off from the station until they could replace the network encryption node. Which was probably a good thing, because he suspected that everything he would have told his wife was a lie. The truth, the one that he didn't think he'd be ever able to admit to her, was that he could be both men at once. He'd already delivered the ultimatum to Kerry Fisk that any colony world that joined the resistance would be destroyed. He understood that, should it become necessary, he could order Overstreet to execute every person on the station that hadn't come through the gates on the Tempest and the Storm. The Marine commander would do it. And that when Natalia and the monster arrived, he would be able to hold them and kiss them and be the man he'd always been around them. And know that he'd made them safe. That was what terrified him. Not that the job would force him to be both of those men, but that he was capable of being both. That all it would take is a bit more pressure, and Santiago Singh would be a man who loved his daughter with all his heart, and who also ordered genocides. He tapped at his desk. "Chief."
"Sir,"
came the immediate reply. "How long until we have the network back up so I can send traffic back through the storm?"
"It's on the priority list. I've been told 11 hours until the replacement system is in place."
"Thank you," Singh said. "Please let me know the instant it's done. I have priority traffic for Laconia."
"Yes, sir."
"Sir, on that topic, the storm reports traffic incoming from the Sol Gate marked highest priority. They have a courier bringing it over now."
"Very well. Bring them directly in," Singh said, then killed the connection.
It seemed too early for the Tempest to be reporting the Sol system's surrender, but he was open for a pleasant surprise. According to his tactical map, they would barely be crossing the asteroid belt now. Their projections placed the earliest expected surrender point at the Mars crossing. Singh needed a distraction to pull himself out of his self-pitying and introspection. Whatever Admiral Trejo needed to tell him so urgently, it was bound to be interesting. The petty officer, who was ushered into his office half an hour later, was a tall woman with pale hair that had been turned dark by sweat. She was breathing heavily, and her uniform was damp.
"Sir," she said, then held out a small black wafer to him.
"You look terrible, sailor," Singh replied, taking the chip. "Are you all right?" "The Marines are using all the carts for patrol duty, so..."
"Did you actually run this over all the way from the storm?"
Because of the attack, traveling from the ship to his office meant donning a vacuum suit, moving through the damaged sections of the station, then removing the suit and running down the long, spiraling ramp that went from the center of rotation down to the drum floor. And after that, a kilometer and a half run across the drum to reach his office complex.
"Yes, sir," the petty officer said, starting to get her breathing under control.
"I'll be sending my compliments to your senior chief. Outstanding effort, sailor. Take a moment to clean up, and we'll round up a cart to drive you back."
"Thank you, sir," she said, then gave him a sharp salute and left.
Part of the self-pity trap that Singh had realized it would be easy to fall into was the terrible sense of being utterly alone in his job. He needed more interactions with his fellow Laconians, with his ship, and the sailors under his command. He needed these reminders that he wasn't working alone, that hundreds of like-minded and dedicated professionals shared the dream of the Empire. Singh made a mental note to spend more time on the storm. He rolled his monitor out onto the desktop and dropped the small black chip on it. "Transfer all files and wipe," he said. Then, when the monitor blinked its acknowledgement, snapped the little black chip in two and dropped it in the recycler. Admiral Trejo's face appeared on his monitor. Singh found he was a little excited. Trejo was a man with even greater responsibility than his own, and one who handled it with dedication and grace. He was a man who always knew the right thing to do, and did it without hesitation. If Singh wanted to spend more time with the Laconian sailors like himself, he wanted to be Admiral Trejo. He told the monitor to play the message. Trejo's face blurred into motion, and his expression became one of puzzlement and maybe even fear. "Sonny, something's happened, and we have no idea what it is or what to do about it. We need some help." He paused, and something like dread took root in his expression. "It seems we've taken on a passenger of sorts." Singh watched the message play out in fascination, and then horror, and then fascination again. The object, there really wasn't any other word to describe it, was a floating sphere of light and darkness hovering about 3 feet off the deck in a corridor on the heart of the Tempest. Just looking at a recording of it on the monitor's small screen made his head hurt. Someone passed a length of pipe through it and back again on the recording. The pipe did not seem to interact with the object at all. And in fact, Singh had the sense that he saw both the pipe and the object at the same time with equal clarity, even when that should be impossible. It made his head hurt even worse. Mercifully, the person with the pipe stopped doing it, and Trejo began speaking. "As you can see, the anomaly doesn't seem to exist as a physical object. It doesn't appear to radiate on any wavelength except for visible spectrum photons. Not one sensing device we've aimed at it can even tell that it's there. But we can record it and see it just fine. Being in the same room with it, looking at it, it's quite disorienting and causes double vision and severe headaches." As if in response to this, 4 sailors set up a curtain around it, using poles and blankets. While they worked, Trejo continued, "It's moving with us, with the ship, because we're still under thrust and it hasn't moved a millimeter since it first appeared. I've tried making some minor course adjustments, but it keeps us as its frame of reference. I've included all the data we've collected on this file, but I can tell you that its first appearance almost exactly matches the moment when we destroyed Palace Station. It also includes a nearly 3-minute blackout shared by every single person on this ship." The sailors had finished setting up their curtain and left. Trejo pulled his monitor close so his face filled the screen. He lowered his voice, as though telling Singh a secret. "If this is some new weapon of the inner planets, we need to understand it, and now. Blacking out a crew for 3 minutes, the right 3 minutes, would create a serious tactical advantage for them. I need you to pass along this information to Laconia through our most secure channels. Get me answers fast, Sonny. I'm about to engage with the combined might of the inner planet's navies, and this is the first thing that's made me wonder if I can win." Singh sank back in his chair and rubbed his face with both hands. What if everything, including the attacks on Medina, had just been a distraction? What if the inner planets needed time to bring some new superweapon to bear? And feints and jabs from the Sol fleet and his own insurgents were just to create confusion and buy time. "Major Overstreet?" Singh said to his monitor.
"Yes, sir."
"I'll need a cart with an armed guard. I'm going to the storm."
"Copy that, sir."
Singh took another data chip out of his desk, laid it on the monitor, and copied all the files Trejo had sent. He then told his monitor to wipe everything. He placed the chip into a lockable metal briefcase and waited for his ride to arrive. While he waited, something tugged at his mind, Some memory from the Academy, maybe. Another mention of a sphere of light and darkness. It had to do with the first wave of colonization, even before the High Consul had led his people to Laconia. He took a moment to have his monitor search the local network for any mention of such an object with the properties Trejo described. The search took less than a second, and what it found was a minor colony world named either Illis or New Terra. In among the list of names connected to what the article was calling the Illis incident was one that his monitor underlined. When he tapped it, he understood why. In the report, Captain James Holden of the Rocinante had reported seeing the exact object that was currently residing on Admiral Trejo's ship. The same James Holden, who was now in their security lockup, under suspicion of terrorist acts. Chapter 36. Bobby. The public prison was full, but not with her people. Laconian guards stood at the corners with weapons drawn, watching the crowd watch the prisoners. Drones buzzed overhead, scanning constantly. On the far side of the steel mesh, men and women sat disconsolately waiting for trial or judgment. Bobby stuffed her fists deep into the pockets of her plain gray jumpsuit. A man at the back of the lowest cell on the left looked a little bit like Holden, but not so much she could talk herself into thinking it was him. Even if they had him, Holden probably wouldn't be put here. This jail was more than half for show, public stocks for a new generation. Anyone with real value to security forces would be somewhere else. Still, she had hoped. It never hurt to hope, except when it did. "Pinche Schwiss alles la," the man next to her said under his breath. She'd been around Belters long enough to translate it in her head. Lousy kids, all of them. The man who'd said it had long brown-gray hair and an expression as sour as old lemons. She only smiled her agreement. This wasn't a place where she wanted to say anything aloud against the Laconians. It turned out it was just as good she didn't. "Esa all the fucking underground, yeah?" he said. "Things aren't hard enough, now they're killing our goddamn station." Bobby felt her smile grow tighter, less sincere. The rage in the man's eyes wasn't for the invaders who'd swept in, destroyed their defenses, and taken over. It was for the people fighting against them. It was for her. "Hard times," she said, because the drones might be listening. She walked away, heading north along the drum. The straight line of sun above her, the ruins of the engineering decks far away at her back. Being out in public like this left her feeling exposed. The Laconians were everywhere, the checkpoints twice as thick as they'd been before, and everywhere she looked, faces shaped by fear. The Laconians' fear that their control over the station hadn't been enough to stop the underground. The locals' fear of Laconian reprisals. Her fear that she'd be found out, or that she'd broken something she wasn't going to be able to mend. Saba's network had managed to get the warning out pretty well. The death toll in the explosion was low. She'd heard a dozen, and most of them Laconian, but it was hard to know what was true. It was as deep in the culture of the Belt as bones in their bodies that you didn't fuck with the environmental systems. She hadn't thought about the symbolic meaning of her plan, or what it took for Saba and Katria to agree to it. To Bobby, they'd been getting important intelligence and covering their tracks. To the Belters, they'd been saying that they would be free of Laconian rule, even if the only freedom was death. If not everyone on the station signed on for that, she couldn't blame them. A swath of green grass lawn on her right had a classroom's worth of children, a teacher talking about insects and soil. A man on a bicycle rode past her, whistling to let people know he was coming and to clear the path. All the things that had happened before Duarte and Trejo and Singh. She couldn't guess how many of the people she was walking past would have turned her into the authorities if they'd known. How many would have applauded her. There was no way for her to ask. That was the trick of living under the thumb of a dictator. It broke every conversation, even the private ones. The invasion had wounded everyone, one way or another, herself very much included. Her hand terminal chimed, and she plucked it out of her pocket with a sense of dread. The message was from Alex, and all it said was, "When you have a minute." The underground was still using encrypted back channels. The security forces wouldn't see the message in their logs, but if Bobby got picked up or someone looked over her shoulder, the words would be innocuous. Saba's cramped halls and corridors were the only place they could speak freely. Everywhere else on Medina had become the land of subtext. She found an escalator and let it carry her down into the body of the drum. It wasn't far to the entry to Saba's alternate station, but they all had to be careful to see they weren't followed. Their bubble of freedom was fragile, and once it popped, it wouldn't come back. Alex was waiting for her when she ducked into the access corridor. The flesh under his eyes looked ashy, and his shoulders slumped like he was under a higher gravity than they were. He smiled, though, and that her friend seemed pleased to see her counted for a lot. For more than it should have, even.
"How's the weather out there?"
he asked, as they made their way down toward the makeshift galley.
"Stormy," she said. "Get the feeling it'll get worse before it gets better."
That was a given.
In the galley, half a dozen of Saba's people sat at the tables talking. The air smelled like noodles and black sauce, but the food was gone. Bobby wasn't hungry anyway. One of Katria's men, a crooked-nosed guy named Jordao, nodded to her, smiling a little too widely. She nodded back with a sense of dread. This was not a time she wanted someone hitting on her.
"Any word?"
she asked, her voice low even though security wouldn't hear her. She wasn't afraid of being found out here, but the wounds were fresh. Some things didn't need to travel outside the family.
"On Holden?"
"No,"
Alex said.
"Okay," Bobby said.
It cut her a little every time there was nothing, and she welcomed it. If it came back that she'd killed him, the hurt would be a million times worse. Every little wound was a good thing, because it wasn't the killing blow.
"That stuff Naomi pulled off the encryption machine?
It's working.
Saba's folks are able to dig through a bunch of stuff we intercepted before. Of course, the storm's not talking to Medina anymore since we blew the channel, so we're not getting anything new. But it makes it rough for the bad guys that they can't have their ship to talk to the station without radio or tight beam, so..."
He trailed off, like his words were running out of pressure.
"So we won," she said. "Go us."
"Doesn't feel like it, does it? I keep asking myself what the hell happened."
"We lost Holden."
Alex shook his head, tapped four fingers on the table.
"Yep, and that's hard. But something happened before that. We've faced all kinds of bad before now, and it never split up the family. It was always everyone else, never us. Now Naomi's off in her room, and Amos is wherever the hell Amos is. You're going for long walks. We used to be a crew. Now it's me and Claire playing cards and worrying about everyone."
She heard the accusation in his voice, and she wanted to push back at him. Only he was right. Something deeper was wrong. Had been wrong.
In the hallway, Saba's voice. A woman replied. It was all too quiet to make out the words. The people at the other table laughed about something. Bobby hunched forward, her scowl deep enough to ache. Holden's not just Holden, she said, knowing it was an evasion, but saying it anyway. He's the face of the Rocinante. He's been on news feed since before I joined up. He's the special man. We pulled this thing off, and we lost one person in the operation. That's a win. If it had been you or me or Claire that got caught, we'd still be celebrating. But it was Holden. Now it feels like we lost our good luck charm.
Feels like that to them, sure, Alex said, pointing to the others with his thumb. But we lost him before, and it didn't break us. Him and Naomi retiring was sad. And then he didn't go away, and that was weird.
Yeah, the whole Captain Draper thing might have worked if he'd actually been out of the picture. Alex leaned forward, talking over her.
But we know better. Whatever's going on with Amos and you, it didn't start when Holden left, or when he came back. It was when that big-ass ship steamed through the gate from Laconia and fucked everything sideways. Now Naomi's curled up in her bunk while everything's still on fire.
She's not helping with the decrypt? Alex shook his head once, sharply.
She can't pull back, Bobby said. She's the best tech on the station. Saba's people are fine, but she's better. She can't just stop working because her lover's dead. Or worse.
Bobby felt the hurt and the guilt again.
We need her, Alex agreed. I'll have a talk with her if you want. Unless you want to be the one who kicks her butt.
I really don't.
Good, because I don't want to be the one who tells Amos to get his shit together. So that one's on you.
To Bobby's surprise, she smiled. For a moment, she could pretend the cramped little galley was the Rocinante. That she and Alex were burning between gates and the stars. She put a hand on his arm, grateful that her friend was there. And that however shitty things got, the plan was still to fix them. Alex's smile was enough to show he understood everything she hadn't spoken.
Right, he said. You're Naomi, I'm Amos. Then if Holden's still alive, we find him, crack him loose, and get the hell out of Dodge before the next big-ass ship comes through that gate.
See?
Now you're talking sense, Alex said.
He sighed.
Which is good, because I thought I was going to have to tell you to stop sulking. And I really wasn't looking forward to the part where you punched me in the mouth.
Saba stood at the wider part of the hallway where an access panel had been taken out and never replaced. He held his arms above his head, bracing against the ceiling with the unconscious ease of somebody ready for a ship that might move unexpectedly. He lifted his chin as Bobby came close.
Hey, I'm looking for Amos, she said.
Problem?
Tell you when I find out, she said. He's not answering his comms.
Saba's brow furrowed.
Que chance que is after Holden?
I wouldn't put the odds high that he'd go on an extraction by himself, Bobby said. Then a moment later.
I mean, not zero, but not high.
See, it stays if you can, Saba said.
We're carrying plenty enough already and more rolling down, yeah?
Something in his voice caught her.
More news?
Saba hesitated, then shifted his head.
Come this way.
You looking for yours, me looking for you.
You want the good word first, or the worrying?
Good, Bobby said. I'm looking for good.
Word from Okoyo and the cleaning crew is Holden's alive. Locked down tight, but not dead.
A tightness released in Bobby's gut. Whatever else happened, she hadn't killed him. And more than that, when she found Amos, she'd have it on her side.
She felt a deep gratitude that she'd run into Saba before he'd found him. She had to let Alex know, and Naomi, and everyone. The relief was profound.
That's... okay. What's the worrying?
Message from the Union. From the spy repeater.
Wait, Bobby said, following him as he walked toward his cabin.
We've got communications lines open? I thought we shut that down.
Turned it back on for this, Saba said. It ate a missile right after. Drummer thought it was worth burning the channel for.
Something big, then. Come see.
Saba had Drummer's message up on his cabin's monitor. The change in her face was shocking. It wasn't only that the president looked tired and thinner. She looked older, like the last few weeks had been measured in years instead of days. Saba didn't speak, but started the message from the beginning. Bobby listened until the end, then played it again, making sure she understood. The loss of Pallas, and the loss of time.
Well, she said, holy shit.
Yeah, Saba said. Got my people going through all the information we intercepted. All that's finished decrypting, anyway. Nothing about lost time or boiling up the vacuum.
Even if we found something, it's not like we can sneak a message back if the repeater's dead.
Not sneak one, no, Saba agreed. Can shout, though, if it was the right time. Medina's not home anymore, not for us.
When we scatter, maybe send something back down to people's home. Tell them what we've got to tell them, if we get anything.
Fair point, Bobby agreed. And that is the plan now, right? Clear a path and evacuate as many as we can before the new ship gets here?
Already putting out the word to the underground, he said.
He sounded as tired as she was.
Just the ones we trust, saying to get ready. Window opens, and get to the ships, and go. Everyone's someplace different. Harder to kill us if we're not in one place.
Even better if they don't know who went where, Bobby said.
I'd love to find a way to take out Medina's sensor arrays when we go.
Would be sweet, Saba said, his voice dull.
You holding up okay? Bobby asked.
Saba shrugged toward the image of Drummer still on the screen.
That woman is my heart, and I lost her. Lost my ship. Lost my place for my people. Got an enemy ship killing my cities and stations, and now it can turn off mines in a whole system at once. Got another one like it breaking toward me. Got all those marines and power armor ready to shoot me and mine through the brain pan, and the loosest mouth on 1,000 worlds is in the enemy's jail. So, given so, I'm all right.
Holden won't rat us out. He's given a lot of unvetted press releases over the years, but that's not the same as this.
They have him, they'll have us. Not talking him down, but these people were Mars before they were this. Ask anyone in the OPA from the old days, Martian interrogation. It's a question of how long until the break, never if. Better that he died.
We can move, Bobby said. Do you have any holes that Holden didn't know about?
Few,
Saba said reluctantly. But fewer now.
My people are moving now. Still room for you and yours, but there won't be. Not for long, and...
He shook his head.
And what?
Bobby said. If there's something more I need to know. Saba shrugged and nodded at the screen.
When it comes. If it comes. The one system we can't go to?
So.
Any place else I can try for. Any place else I can go.
But no matter where it is, she won't be there.
Wasn't so bad when the repeater still was, but with it gone, it feels...
A tear tracked down Saba's brown cheek. Bobby looked away. It was so easy to forget all the others. Not just Saba, but all of them. The crews of all the ships trapped in the dock beside the Rossi. The children in Medina's schoolrooms, the medical staff and the clinics. The artists playing music live outside the cafes out of love of doing it. Medina Station had been the nearest thing to a void city before the void cities were built. It was a home for a generation of people, and every one of them was carrying something now that made their days harder. She thought of the prisoners in the public jail, the angry man who'd come to watch them. Who had he lost back on Sol? What was keeping him awake in the nights? There were so many families, so many crews, parents and children, lovers and friends, whose lives had been changed past recognition since Laconia Gate had opened. It wasn't just her and the Rossi crew. It wasn't just Saba. Everyone was dancing on this same landslide, and no one knew how to make it end well. She wanted to say something comforting, but she couldn't bring herself to lie. The best she could think of was to change the subject. "When we get out," she said, "not if, when, we're going to need a plan. If every ship just bolts off on its own, we'll lose contact. They shouldn't know where we went, but we should. At the very least, we should have a record of who went where." This every man for himself and God against all shit's romantic, but we have to plan for something past just this. Saba nodded. In the distance, voices and footsteps. "Not just encrypted, but in code," Saba said. "Something where only we know what it means." "We?" "U'ime," Saba said. "Leaders of the underground, us. First among dissidents." Bobby chuckled. "Well, there's a fucking job title." The footsteps came faster now, coming closer. Saba looked up like an animal smelling smoke. "Fuck," Bobby thought. "Not something else. It's too much already. We can't carry something else." The woman who appeared in Saba's doorway was older, white-haired, pulled back in a tight braid. Her body was long and thin, her head a little too large for her shoulders, the classic build of someone who'd grown up without gravity to hold her down. She even had the split circle of the OPA tattooed on her arm. She should have looked ancient, but the brightness in her eyes belonged in a woman a third her age. She looked from Saba to Bobby and back with something like triumph in her eyes. "Maha?" Saba said. "Ke?" And then to Bobby. "Maha, one of our best communication techs. Had her hands in the code since before I was born, yeah? And I know all their secrets," she said in a weirdly accented voice. She held out a dumb terminal that wasn't connected to Medina's system. "The new decryption run turned over some stones, and look you, what was squirming under one." Bobby was closer. She took the handheld terminal and flipped through the file there. It was titled, "Medina Station Supplementary Security Review as Requested by Governor Santiago Singh." The file's creator was listed as Major Lester Overstreet. She checked the file length and whistled. "Ke?" Saba said. "This is way too long to just be an incident report," Bobby said. "It's..." The section headings were materials, procedures, personnel, protocols, audit summary, recommendations. She recognized the style of paragraph marking from when she'd trained back on Olympus Mons. It looked like an MMC security report, but twice as long. Maybe three times. She shifted through one after another, her head starting to swim a little. "I think, Saba, I think this is everything," she said. Chapter 37. Alex. His back hurt.
Of all the thousand things that were jacked up and wrong in his life right now, the one that chose to make him crazy was that. His back hurt.